Good afternoon. So last time, we finished up talking about network file systems by talking about caching, that one thing we lost when we said we were going to like forward all our reads and writes to a remote machine is that, well, now we lost our page cache as a benefit of just reading from memory. We might be reading from memory on the file server, but we have to pay the cost of going over the network, and often that can be milliseconds, which is way, way, way slower than memory. So we want to actually do our caching locally, but that's a challenge because if someone using a different machine, a different client, is editing the same things, we might not have our cache be in sync. And we talked about NFS's main solution to the problem, which is they said, well, it's okay if it's not in sync sometimes. They just chose to only have it not be in sync in what they would hope were atypical use cases by having this open to close consistency model that we write on, we make sure the server's updated on close, we make sure our cache is up to date on open. We also talked about an alternate strategy where we say, well, maybe we don't need our server to be completely stateless, and we have our server keep track of who has a copy of the file. This is something which is, you know, less sensitive to keep track of than who has files open because, well, it's easy to reconstruct and, you know, the cost of losing it is some inconsistency. And we can have these callbacks where a server just sends a message saying, hey, someone tried to access that thing you have cached. We also talked about a different sort of thing we might want to do with a network file system, sort of the Dropbox model of the world, which is we want things to work when we're actually disconnected. And this is something we can just use our cache for. We just say, we're gonna cache a whole bunch of data, work on the cache data, and if we don't have a network connection, that's okay. We just modify our cache, and later on, we update our cache, you know, at the central server. And this is a fine model with the minor problem of what if two people are at the same file? Now we don't have open to close consistency, and we might in fact know that two people updated the file without seeing each other's updates at different times. And we want some way of resolving that. And there's not really a really elegant solution because, you know, what you need to do depends on what type of file you have. We talked about our second topic last time, which was distributed transactions. So with distributed transactions, the idea is multiple machines agree to either definitely do something, to commit an operation, or definitely not do something. We talked about a protocol for doing this, even if machines fail, called two-phase commit, where multiple machines obtain unanimous agreement to do the operation, and only then do they do it. And we recover from any failure by having some careful use of hopefully persistent logs and using that redo logging strategy where we record something and when we come back up, we do what the log says we were intending to do, even if we had already done it before. We might just do it again. We talked about two-phase commit as a way of having all the machines agree to do something, and if one machine goes away, it needs to come back before we can actually finish the operation. But sometimes that's not acceptable. Sometimes we want to be using multiple machines in order to tolerate some of those machines not working. And in cases like that, we can use this quorum model, where instead of having everyone agree that, yes, this is what's happening, which we needed in two-phase commit because like one machine had half the data the other machine had. In this quorum model, everyone can do the operation. We just want to have extra copies of it. So we only need some sort of majority vote, because a majority is enough to make sure that someone's always going to vote no if what we're asking you to do conflicts with something which has already happened. Because someone's going to be in that what would need to be a majority and have seen anything else that happened with a majority. Like maybe most of the people in the majority haven't, but to get a majority, someone needs to have seen each prior operation. And we mentioned that the details of this are very tricky, mainly because like we need to think about what happens if a failure happens at every possible point, including with things like our leader or coordinator, you know, that are like count and votes and things like that. We need to handle all those cases, and it turns out to be very, very tricky, but there are systematic ways of doing it that work with this majority model. So any questions about what we talked about last time? Yeah. Question is, when you have a quorum, how do you make sure you get the latest version? So typically, you have some sort of sequence number, and you need to do that because you want to, when you do your update, you want to make sure when you're done, as much as possible, everyone's up to date. You said a modification time. It's a bit tricky because one of the things that we need a majority vote to prevent is, what if I try to do two different operations at roughly the same time? We need to agree on which one happens first. So we're not going to use a modification time for that. The biggest reason is that we probably can't guarantee our machine's clocks are exactly in sync. So modification time isn't the right tool. And you know, if we were relying on it, we'd be saying they have to be like in sync to like the microsecond. Okay, so any other questions? Okay, so our topic for this time is going to be about security and access control. So first I'd like to talk about two related concepts that people talk about with operating systems. One is protection, and the other is security. And these often sound like they're the same thing. And we're going to use them to mean different things. When people talk about operating systems, they mean different things. So protection are mechanisms for controlling access to resources. So like page tables can be used as a protection mechanism. They keep you from accessing memory you're not supposed to, or accessing memory in ways you're not supposed to, like writing to memory that should be read-only, and so on. And preemptive scheduling keeps you from using all the CPU ever by preempting you. That's a mechanism for doing that. Encryption keeps you from interpreting data that you're not supposed to. So these are all protection mechanisms that control access to something. Security is the application of that, and the important piece that security should have that protection doesn't have is that there's some policy we're enforcing that makes sense. So the security aspect is not that I set up a page table, but that I made sure that the things in my page table that are read-only were supposed to be read-only, and that are invalid were supposed to be invalid, that I set that part of it up right. And there's some policy I needed to decide to do that. And that policy is often very abstract, like, you know, I shouldn't be able to access these files, or bad people shouldn't be able to access my files. And we need to turn that into something that we can concretely express with these mechanisms. And in this lecture, I'm going to mostly be talking about mechanisms and not policies. So we're missing this giant piece of the sort of security picture of, given that we have all these tools, how do we actually use them? And this is not a straightforward problem, and not a problem I have solutions to, and I'm telling you here, well, not really a problem I'm going to try to solve. I'm just going to give you some mechanisms that are going to be flexible enough that there's a lot of policies they can enforce. But an important part of actually applying them is figuring out what do those policies look like, and how do I express them with these mechanisms. But since we are talking about security, something we should note about security is that security is about adversaries. And adversaries are different than like what we're thinking of when we're talking about making sure programs don't accidentally do something bad. So for example, we had our guard page. The guard page is there to make it so if you accidentally go off the end of your stack, you get an error. adversaries aren't about accidents. The adversary is doing the worst possible thing, and our protection mechanisms need to not detect mistakes, they need to detect the worst possible thing and deal with it. And the adversary will do the most clever thing to get around it. And that's going to be a challenge with our protection mechanisms, that they really can't have any holes. They can't just be something where we usually figure out that you're accessing a file you're not supposed to. We need to always figure it out. No exceptions, no corner cases. And this is something that our protection mechanisms need to have that's beyond some of the things we might have just to prevent bugs. Okay. Now, a common thing we think about when talking about protection and security is that we want to identify specific people. That often, if you ask me, what policy should I have for access to my files, you're going to say, like, oh, your course files should be accessed by instructors and not students. You're identifying people who should be able to do something. So an important part of our protection mechanisms is having something that can represent people, actors in our system. And there's two things related to that that we're going to talk about. So one is authentication, that we need some way of identifying who is using our system. And this is going to be called authentication. There's a separate concept known as authorization, which is going to be identifying, given that we know who it is, we've done the authentication part of identifying who's using our system, what are they allowed to do? So we have authentication first, given that, then we have the second part, which is, given that we've authenticated the user, what are they allowed to do, what files can they access, and so on. So authentication is a hard problem, and a problem with many, many solutions. We can use a password, we can use some sort of physical hardware token like one of these, we can use, you know, biometrics, there's lots of things we can use. And I'm going to mostly ignore the problem. We're just not going to really deal with how. We're going to deal with someone does the authentication, how do we use that information? And part of the reason we're going to do this is, as you'll see, it's very common for operating systems to kind of delegate the authentication to something else. And that's not really a core part of the operating system functionality. So we're just going to track after the authentication is done who was authenticated and work with that information. So questions about my setup here? Okay. So we want to do then this authorization problem of, given that we know who it is, what can they access? So we need to represent that information in some way. And one way we can think about this is we just have a giant table that we have a bunch of what we'll call domains, and we'll say that processes are going to be assigned to these protection domains, and these represent our authentication. So we say that a process is my process, therefore it belongs to the user CR4BD protection domain, because I'm the user responsible for that, and maybe some others like the faculty protection domain. And this is done by our authentication process. And for each of these domains, we're going to just have this giant table of, for every possible thing in our system, what can some process that's a member of that domain do? So we have a bunch of objects, like files, processes, where we want to restrict who can access them. And we just fill out this table. And the process of how do you fill out this table is our policy question that I said we would mostly ignore. So this is a mechanism where, as long as we can express our policy in the form of this giant table, we're going to do that. So think of this table as something we could actually store. And it's probably going to be a sparse table. Like, for most files, we aren't going to actually separately decide each user can or can't access them. It's mostly going to be blank entry saying no. And what we want to do is we want to do a lookup in this table whenever, say, a program tries to read a file or write a file and figure out, okay, the program is in protection domain 2 and 7. Let's see if any of those let it read the file or write the file. So that's the sort of operation the operating system is going to do with this table, is that whenever a process tries to access any one of these resources, we have a list of the domains it's in. We look up each of those domains in the table and figure out if it's allowed to do that operation. If there's no entry in the table, it's not allowed to do it. Yeah? The process can be in multiple domains. So the process can be in multiple domains? Yes. So my example here is I might have a process that's in my user domain and the CS faculty group domain. Yeah?
I think your mic turned off.
My mic is, yes. And we'll see if I can fix that while we're talking. So, any other questions? Actually, we'll do our... Okay, so we have this giant table, and there are a bunch of ways we could represent it. And one of the more common ones is that we're not just going to have this big table somewhere, it's that we'll store the information about who can access what with the objects themselves. So for example, for each file, we'll store what protection domains are allowed to read and write it. And this idea is known as an access control list. So the file has a list of who can access it. Maybe the process has a list of who can access it, and so on. And we store that with the objects. So that's one possible mechanism. Another type of mechanism is we could just like store this table on the side. And this is really done in some systems. So there's something called AppArmor on Linux, where you just have a configuration file saying, this program, this thing is what it's allowed to access or not allowed to access. And you can just store that information on the side. In any case, you just have some way of looking up object domain, is it in there? Let's talk about access control lists and be more concrete about this. So we have these two parts for our access control lists. We're going to talk about both of these problems. So one problem is I talked about these protection domains in order to use our access control lists, you know, what those are. And we need to figure out how those get assigned to a process and how we track what protection domains a process is in. And typically, we're going to assign a process to a protection domain for what we call a user and for one or more groups, where groups might represent things like I'm a faculty member or I'm in a particular research project, something hopefully useful for figuring out who should access files and other policy decisions we make. And then the object will list users and groups. So, to represent users, we need some way of identifying them for the operating system. And the most common procedure is that the process will have what's known as a user ID, or one or more user IDs, which is typically just a number. And every process has one, and that's what's used to identify what they're authorized to do. And this is, in fact, what POSIX uses. So POSIX has user IDs, and you can get the processes what's known as the effective user ID with the get EUID library call, which is usually also a system call. So this would be something we'd add to the process control block, is the effective user ID of the process. And it's just a number the kernel keeps track of, and it checks it against these access control lists whenever you do things like open, etc. Now, this is just a number, but you're used to seeing, like, user is like a string you put in, like your computing ID. So there's some mapping that maps this to names, typically. And this is maintained by just standard programs in the library, but in the typical POSIX system, the kernel part of the operating system knows nothing about the names. It only cares about numbers. There's just some user programs and libraries that keep track of what those numbers mean as far as names that you can print out easily. Okay. So that's user IDs. I mentioned we also want to assign programs to groups. So we also have group IDs. So there's an effective group ID you can get with the get EGID library call. That's another thing we just keep in our process control block. And it turns out we want processes to have multiple groups they belong to sometimes. So we actually keep, POSIX keeps a list of those groups, and there's a get groups call to get that list. This is another thing that's just going to be an array inside our process control block of these group IDs. And it's, again, IDs. The kernel only knows about numbers. There are names for these, but the names are just tracked by user programs and libraries to make it convenient for you to know what does it mean that I'm in group ID 73. Okay. Yeah.
So do these calls return the effective IDs for the current process it's running?
This question is, what process do these return it for? These are all for the current relaying process. These IDs are one of the things that is inherited on things like fork. Yeah. Because remember, fork copies the whole process. This is part of the process, are all these IDs. So that means that we can run a program that prints out these IDs, and there, in fact, is one that is installed standardly on most POSIX systems. So for example, on some department machine, there's a command called ID that lists the user ID, the group ID, and the group list, just the return values of those system call, those library calls I showed you earlier. And it also looks up the name with the standard library code. Not the kernel doesn't know about the names, but it looks them up, so that makes it more convenient. And you can see that I have a user ID and a bunch of group IDs associated with all the programs I'm running. And this was somehow set up when I logged into the machine. All these user IDs and group IDs were set. And because I'm not changing them, when I spawn new programs, I fork, it has the same user ID and group ID. They run with all those IDs. Okay, so questions? So the groups you see here are groups which just seem to correspond to who I am. This is not the only thing we have to use groups for. So it doesn't have to be the case that all my programs are going to be in the same groups. So for example, one thing we might do is, let's say we have a device to represent our monitor on our machine. A way we might control access to that monitor is we might say, if you're logged into the machine physically, you should be able to access the monitor, otherwise you shouldn't. So a way we might try to achieve that is we'll have a video group which has access to the device file for the monitor. And if you're logged in to the machine directly, you'll get your processes will be assigned that group ID for the video group, so you'll be able to access the monitor. If you SSH in, we don't put you in that group. So your SSH programs can't access the monitor. So we can control access in ways other than saying this user can do particular things. We can control based on more particular things about the program you're running. So questions? Yeah. Okay, so those are our group IDs and user IDs, and we have to use them to figure out what resources we can access. And this shows up most often with files, partly because files represent things like, as I said, devices like monitors. So it's how we control what programs can access what devices. And files also represent your data on a shared machine. That's usually what you most care about someone accessing when they're not supposed to. So POSIX has file permissions, which are a very restricted access control list. And who's used chmod before? So those chmod is manipulating this extremely restricted access control list. So in this model, there's one user ID associated with the file known as the owner. And the owner, by virtue of being the owner, always can change the permissions. That's one of the things of here. And it also has a read, write, and execute bit, saying whether the owner can read, write, or execute the file. Not that it's especially relevant from a security point of view, because the owner can also change those permission bits. Each file is associated with one group, and there are ways of changing that group to another group that you're part of. So there's one group ID, and there's a read, write, and execute bit for the group. And then there's a default setting if you aren't any of those for that. And this is the flag. So chmod controls these flags here and this group ID. There's a chgrp command that can change that. So this is an access control list. It just has a very restricted form. We can't just list whatever protection domains we want. It doesn't look like that access matrix I showed you as far as the level of flexibility we have. But it's enough to represent some useful policies. And note that kind of unlike that access matrix we have this default setting which it wasn't clear how to represent in that access matrix other than by like putting something in everything in the whole column. We have a way of doing that. And it's common with access control lists. So there also are, in practice, more flexible file permissions. So this is pretty inflexible. And POSIX and, it turns out, Windows and NTFS support a much more flexible permission schemes. Which they call these access control lists. So the default scheme, it's an access control list by our definition, just a very, very restricted one. But these are more like what people typically think of when they say access control list. They're just a list, and you can put lots, you can make the list basically as big as you want. So it's a list of a user and a group and a bunch of permissions that user and group has. And there's a version standardized by POSIX, which is sometimes supported, sometimes not. So here's what the POSIX access control list looks like. There's a text syntax. This is not what the kernel sees. This is translated to numbers, because remember, the kernel doesn't deal with names. But this is the format for the tools for setting this up. So you see we have a list of group. We can say students can read and execute this file or these files, but not write it. Faculty can read, write, and execute these files. The user MST3K, even if they're a student, they can read, write, and execute it. And the user TJ1A can't do anything with it, even if they're a student or a faculty. So you can set these sort of very fine-grained permissions with things like exceptions for particular users, because POSIX made a choice with these rules that the user rules take precedence over the group ones. So you can specify these exceptions for users where they have more or less permissions, even though they're members of groups, which as a whole have different permissions. And using this, we can express lots of policies, for who can access particular files. And basically, what the operating system is going to do with this is it's going to go through this list of rules, find the best matching rule, and use that to decide, based on what process is running and what groups it's in, whether it's allowed to open a file or some other operation with the file, renaming it in the, or so on. So questions? The scheme? And Windows supports something similar. So this is like a real scheme for more fine-grained than our chmod permissions, where we can't like easily specify these two people can access the file here. That's very simple. So I mentioned how we represent these permissions, and then we need to check them. And the way that works on Unix is that this is one of the things our system call implementations are going to do. So for files, for like open, rename, unlink, link, and so on, part of that system call is before we do the operation, we look at the access control list, figure out, is this current process, does it have a user ID or a group ID that lets it do that operation? If not, just return an error from the system call. And we just need to have every single file accessing system call work that way. And we're going to do something similar for other resources. So for example, we don't want it to be the case that you can kill any process of mine if we're on a shared system. And the typical policy is that processes can be killed only by processes with the same user ID. So we'll do that check there. And you can think of the process as having a one entry access control list, which always has to be the same as its user ID as far as who can access it. Okay, so questions about this idea? So note that I've written on the slide, you don't rely on libraries to do the checks. So what's the problem with relying on the libraries to do the checks? Why can't I have my system call wrapper? Why don't I just put it there? That's the problem. Yeah.
We could just not use the wrapper.
Yes, so we could just not use the library. So an important part of this is that all these checks need to be implemented in, you know, our kernel mode code. We can't rely on anything the user program is doing implementing these checks. It's something that has to happen in the kernel mode code. Okay, so that's sort of the basics of our access control list. Now, there's some mysteries we have. First, I'd like to get to something you've probably seen before, which is, you know, system administrators. So how do we deal with that? And POSIX has a way of dealing with it, which is known as a super user or root user. And the convention that typical Unix systems make is that user ID 0 is just going to be special. That we'll just have some system calls that only work for the administrator, like shutting the machine down. We're going to make sure your user ID is 0. So we're not going to have an explicit access control list for that, but the most common strategy is we just say user ID 0 is allowed to do this, no one else is. It's just a fixed access control list for the shutdown operation. And another thing that typical Unix systems do with user ID 0 is that they say, we're just going to let this user ID bypass all the permission checks. And this is how we're going to let the system administrator do whatever they need to do. And this is nice because this means the system administrator can now fix things like, what if I set up this access control list wrong? Well, the system administrator ignores all the access control list checks, so they can fix that even if we set it up really badly. But the disadvantage is now we have some user who can do anything, and if any bad person gets access to that user, we're in trouble. But this is the scheme that typical, you know, Unix systems use. And certainly a nice simple scheme, because basically we just have an extra if statement in all these system calls, which says, if UID is 0, then just don't do all this access control list stuff. Okay. And we'll get back to this a bit later, since you're probably there might be some commands you've run which are related to this, like sudo. Let's talk about logging into machines first. So when I log into a machine, you know, type your username, type your password, and now you're running as some particular user. And login is not generally something that's part of the kernel. This is actually just a user program that you are typing input to. So this is a program which is going to check if your password's correct. And based on that, it's going to change user IDs and run a shell for you. So first, it needs to check if your password is correct. And because this is just a program, the kernel doesn't actually know how passwords are stored. It's just there's just some programs which take in passwords and after that sometimes tell the kernel, hey, yeah, it was, hey, just change to this user, please. And in order to be able to do that, to change to another user, they're running as this special user ID 0. This is another purpose of the user ID 0 is for programs like this login program, which needs to be able to change user IDs, and which we're trusting to check passwords. So there's going to be some way this program checks passwords, and there's a lot of solutions out there. So the traditional Unix solution on a single user system, one that's not shared on a network, is a special file known as etcshadow. So you just make a file and you set its access control list so only UID0 can read it or write it. And that's where you store the password information. That's one solution. And the login program reads that file, checks your password, and if it matches, then it switches users and moves on. Another machine system is, well, if you have like a whole network of machines, like our department, we have a whole bunch of machines you can log into. We want you to have the same password on all of them. We don't want to update the passwords on every single machine separately when you change your password. So a common solution is we have a network service that stores all your passwords. And the login program in that case is going to contact that service and give it something about your password. And it's going to say, yep, it's that right user, or no, it's not. And typically, there's some cryptography involved, so we can have a trusted way of knowing that we're talking to the server and not some random person who plugged into the network and made a machine that pretended to be that server. But we have this network service, and that's how we actually do the authentication. And this can be a pretty complicated thing, and that's fine because it's not kernel code. We can make new versions of the login program as much as we want, depending on how we're doing our authentication. And we could like even do things like require you to insert a token device and communicate with that, use biometrics, because it's all user space code. The only thing special about our login program is when it's run and that it's run with, and it's run with UID equals 0. Like, that's the only thing that's special about the login program. It's just that it's run at the beginning and it's run as super user, as that user which can change user IDs and all those other special operations. So we don't need to change our kernel to change any of these policies. Okay, so questions? So then we have this second phase. We need to change user IDs. So in POSIX, there's system calls for changing user IDs. And there's a surprising number of them. You would think there'd like be one. There's more than one. We'll mostly talk about just this one, which is set UID. So if you're a super user and you pass a user ID, it sets the effective user ID to that value. If you're not super user, it may or may not change the user ID depending on a bunch of things we'll talk about later. It also sets two other user IDs. So it turns out in POSIX that programs have multiple user IDs. We'll talk about why they have multiple user IDs later. And it happens to set a bunch of other ones too. But the important thing is that this lets our login program, once it figures out you enter the right password, fork off or just change its own user ID and then run a shell for you. And the shell is running with your user ID. It doesn't have access to all the things the login program had access to. Like, you're not able to read the etcshadow that contains the passwords because you're running not as root anymore. You're running with a different UID. And so this is a mechanism where these programs can just voluntarily restrict their access if they're super user. Okay, so questions so far? So that's logging in. Now, another thing you've probably done with your VM, or in some VM in some class, is the sudo command. So you type sudo, and it asks for your password, which it checks somehow, and we just said that we need to read this file that only root can read. And then it changes and runs something. It turns out as user ID 0 as root. And we're just running this in our normal shell, which is running as us. And remember I said the way the user IDs are set, we fork, the user ID is the same. So how does this get to run things as root? Because you can't call set UID 0, like that's a valid library call. But if you do that, the system's going to say, you're not super user, I'm not letting you do that. And it's just going to return an error. But this somehow runs things as root. So there's something special about the sudo executable to make this happen. And the way that Unix implements this is that we have an extra little bit of data on executable files where we can mark the executable as what's known as set user ID. And we have this rule that if that bit is set, when we exec that program, the system call that does the exec, in addition to loading the program, it's going to change the process's effective user ID to the owner's of the file ID, to the user ID of the file. So sudo is owned by root, marked this way. So when we run it, we call exec, and exec loads the sudo executable and also makes the current process be run by super user, by that UID 0. And this is, in fact, one of the things you can set with chmod. So u plus s sets the set UID flag on a file. Questions? So our sudo program is basically doing the same thing the login program did, but it's decide, you know, it's checking the password, figuring out whether it can run things. It's not running things as us, it's running them as root, but it works the same way the login program did. It just needs to start running as root, even though it wouldn't start as root naturally. And this is the mechanism by which we do that. So we can think of these set user ID programs as sort of gates. They're controlled access to more privileges. And this allows us to, like sudo, make these authorization and authentication decisions without getting the kernel involved. The kernel doesn't know that you're supposed to be able to enter a password and run certain commands as root. It's never told that. All it knows is that there's this program I should run as root, and it figures out that that's the policy. So this is a very flexible mechanism for implementing all these extra policies that we might have. We just write a program that figures out, are you allowed to do the thing, and sets user IDs to let you do it. And we can do this to like give you access to very restricted sets of things. If we want you to be able to do one particular thing as root, like change your password, you know, that changing your password might be editing this file that only root can edit. We can give you a set user ID program that just does that, just changes your password, and rewrites that whole special file, but does it in a way where we know you aren't getting access to anyone else's passwords, and you aren't editing anyone else's passwords, because we wrote that program to make sure it just did exactly that. So you just make that program be owned by root, mark it set user ID, and just make sure you've written that program carefully to make sure it does the right thing. And these are all over the place. There's lots of cases where you might want to have programs like this, where there's some particular thing which requires extra privileges, and this might be a simple way of giving those extra privileges. So for example, let's say I plug in a USB stick on Linux. The most common way that that gets mounted for me so I can access it like a file system is with a set user ID program. And that program can enforce these extra restrictions that wouldn't be enforced if we just like let anyone call mount or let anyone access the USB stick. Like we can say that when you mount, you're mounting into a directory that doesn't replace something sensitive. You aren't mounting inside someone else's home directory. Because that would, you know, let you do very dangerous, confusing things, at least. We can make sure that you can mount the USB stick, but you can't mount normal hard drives. And we can enforce that even if the kernel doesn't have specific code to like check a different access control list for accessing normal hard drives versus USB sticks. We can also set things up so you can't mount set user ID root files. We can pass options to mount saying, hey, this file system should do something different with set user ID, and we can make sure that always happens because we have the set user ID program which controls exactly how mount is called, and we'll only call it in ways which don't let you have new set user ID root files. We can also use this to let you access a particular device. Now, it probably would be better to do this with file permissions on the device, but another way is set user ID. But notably, we can do more restricted things. So like we could have not set user ID as root, but we could have like a printer user, and you run a program that set user ID for the printer, and it knows how to talk to the printer, and it makes sure that like we can enforce things like you don't print 1,000 pages, or you don't send things to the printer that the printer will not understand and might break it. And we can enforce that sort of policy by having the set user ID program that handles your access to that device. We can do things like have a log file that's append only, even if our file system, you know, permissions, we don't have an append. It's just read or write, it's just write or not. But we can make this sort of pseudo append only permission by having you not append directly to a file, but call this program that only knows how to append. And another example that's relevant to our current assignment is if you wanted to bind to a port number less than 1,024, only root can do that, but you can make a set user ID program which does that, then calls another program with that file descriptor still open. And not as root anymore. Yeah.
So does a set UID program check what user called that program, or is that just handled by the executable permissions on the program?
So the question is, does a set user ID program check what called that program? So, or is that handled by permissions on itself? So there's the normal permission checking happens for every program that, you know, if the program is marked as not, you know, if you don't have this execute permission, you can't execute it. So that applies to set UID programs just like normal programs. The set UID program also is going to have a way of figuring out what user ID ran it before the user ID was changed. So it can also do additional checking beyond what the file system did. Other questions? Okay. So you can think of a set user ID program as sort of letting you write a sort of custom syscall sort of thing. Syscall is like controlled access for things the kernel can do. And set UID programs are like controlled access for things root or some other user can do. But it's the same idea, and you just choose what the interesting system call type operations are by writing your set user ID program. So set user ID programs are a nice, super flexible mechanism, especially since we can, as you alluded to, we can do things like check what user called us, which the sudo program does to know what password do I expect. But they are extremely difficult to write securely. And the reason is that they inherit all the state of your program except the user ID. So what if, for example, standard in, standard out, and standard error start close? Do you handle that? Or do you open a file and then assume file descriptor 1 must be standard out and not the file you just opened? And, you know, so for example, if you assume it's standard out, maybe the file you open is the password file. And now you're outputting something to the password file that you didn't intend to. Like, that's a really subtle bug that you would never think of, because who runs your programs with file descriptor 1 closed. No one does that, but the adversary using your setuid program might. If you know about the path environment variable, that's how shells figure out where's the ls command. Maybe your path is set to point to a special copy of the ls command that doesn't list the directory, but in fact modifies the password file. You know, what if we run your program with literally no arguments? Not like just the name, but argc is 0. Do you crash? Do you access bad memory? Who knows? And there's a whole bunch of other things which could go wrong. So set user ID programs, it's super flexible, but it's super error prone. Any little bug in a set user ID program and you might be in huge trouble. And it's huge trouble because the person calling you can do all sorts of weird things when they set up how you're called. You know, all the sorts of things that like cause problems with your shell and more that confused this program. And to give a particular example of something which is especially difficult, so let's say we have a printing program that's marks set user ID to a special user that accesses the printer. And it just takes in the file to print on the command line. So, takes in the file to print. And can the printing program just open the file? Let's say, you know, our printer, like, to keep things simple, let's say it's marked set UID and it's owned by root. You know, our printer, we didn't have specialized things. It's owned by root. So set user ID root program, access the printer. Can we just call open? So what's the problem with just calling open? There is a problem. Yeah. Yeah, so one concern is what if I print etsy shadow, that file that contains our passwords? That would be not a good thing. So let's have a simple solution here. And this is a solution that doesn't work. So we check if the original user can read the program. We just look up who called us, and then we see, does the access control list allow them to read it? There's in fact even a POSIX library call for this. Then we open the file and close it. So this seems like a working solution, but it doesn't achieve the goal we want. And this is one of the reasons why it's one of the examples of why it's super hard to write safe set user ID programs. And the problem is a race condition. Can someone tell me what that, give me an idea of like what this would look like? Why would it go wrong? Yeah. Yeah, so your problem is the permissions change here. Yes, and the answer is yes. So how would the permissions change? So you could lose access. So one issue is maybe the permissions are changing as we're printing. Now there's a trickier issue, which is that what the file name refers to can change. So for example, I'm going to create toprint.txt, and then I'm going to, you know, while it's in between when it checks if I can access that, which I can, I'm going to delete it and replace it with a new file. And I'm going to use the link command to make a copy of that, to make that file. You know, another directory entry for that file. I could also use a symbolic link, but I'm going to just make a different file with that name that points to the same thing as this file I'm not supposed to be able to read. I can do that with link to make a new directory entry with the same inode. I can make a symbolic link. But now, when we open to print.txt, it's in fact opening slash secret. Yeah?
Would you not be prevented from linking to a secret file like that?
So the question is, would you not be prevented? So it turns out the answer is no. But we have the same problem if I do a symlink. And I can put anything in a symlink because it's just a pointer to a different name. And there are versions of this which are, so another version of this attack would be that I could have a directory slash foo which contains shadow. And what I do is I get rid of foo and make slash foo is a symbolic link to slash etsy in that window between when it checks can you access foo shadow and opening it. And symbolic links we can have used to, you know, have shortcut other names for directories, so that would work. So this category of problem is known as often a time of use bug. And it is a very common form of security bugs related to checking these things like access control lists. It's also the sort of bug that like a bad operating system could have in like the system call implementation. If you implement open wrong, you could do the same thing. Hopefully you don't. Now, for a set user ID program, the solution for this is that we're going to have a mechanism where you can temporarily become the original user, open the file, and then become root again. Become for the purposes of open checking the permissions correctly and actually opening the right file. And we know once we open the file, it can't change anymore. We have the same file open, so it's not a problem. And this is why, as I alluded to earlier, we had multiple user IDs in a process. And this allows us to keep the track of information to allow us to do this temporary swapping for things like opening files as a different user with the operating system checking, can that user open this file? So you can temporarily tell the OS, hey, I want to open things as, you know, CR4BE, even though I'm really root. So that's going to be our solution. So first, as a note, you might say this seems like awfully hard, especially if we're doing things like getting rid of changing the entire directory. You know, how, like, this seems like something that's hard to exploit and maybe not practical. It turns out there are ways of making this really consistent. And one idea is that you can use a whole lot of symbolic links. And the idea is that when you do the access check or open, the operating system needs to take a lot of time following all these symbolic links. And that makes the open and access check really slow, which gives you a lot of time to sneak in and change the last symbolic link to point somewhere else. So it turns out there are ways of making this not only, you know, practical, but something that doesn't require a lot of tries to sneak in that what looks like a tiny window of time. And this is why dealing with adversaries is really hard. Like, you think of race conditions as, it doesn't happen very often. When the adversary is working, it's going to happen all the time. Because they'll make sure that they'll arrange things to give them the best chance of sneaking in. Okay, so let's talk about this swapping user IDs. So I said there's multiple user IDs, so let's go through them. So POSIX has three user IDs for every process. There's the effective user ID. It's called the effective because it's the one that actually determines what you can access. Determines what open does, and so on. It looks at the effective user ID. But for set user ID programs, we also want to know who started me. Partly for like sudo, so I can figure out what password am I expecting. And there's a real user ID for that, which you can get with the get UID system call. So confusingly, the real user ID isn't the one that most system calls actually care about. It's not the one that determines your permissions. It's the one that ran set UID. There's also a third UID, and you might say, why do we need a third one? And the answer is that there's history. It's not a good reason. But there's a third one called the saved set user ID, which was the user ID before the last exec. This is something you can't easily get directly in POSIX, but Linux has a special function that only Linux has, and like OS X won't have it, called getResUID that can get it. And the rule POSIX has is that there's a system call you can use to swap the effective user ID with either your real or saved user ID. So you can be running set user ID, and then you swap the two, open a file, swap them back. And that's how you can make sure that open doesn't run with the permissions of root and can't like read the password file. Okay, so questions? And as I said, you might wonder, why are there so many? The historical reason is that there were originally two different variants of Unix. There was System 5 and BSD. And System 5 said, okay, we're going to have this effective user ID, and we're going to save the user ID before exec, but we're not going to like have a function to access and change that. We're just going to save it. And we're going to give a way to swap the two. You can swap back. And BSD had this effective user ID and real user ID solution. And POSIX, as a committee, needed to decide, hey, what do we put in this standard document? And they said both. We'll do both. We don't want to break anything. But this means that if you actually ever need to write a set user ID program, it's really confusing. In particular, the setting functions are really confusing. So you might say, set UID, what does that do? It changes all of the user IDs. Not what I would have guessed, especially since get UID gets the real one. But set UID doesn't set the real one, it sets all of them. Get EID, EUID sets the effective one to some value, and get RUID changes the real and effective at the same time. Sometimes also changes the safe one, but not always, because bad history. So if you actually need to know, this paper is a very thorough exploration of all these, including finding some bugs in real software because of how annoyingly complicated this is. It's just annoyingly confusing. But the key operation that all this scheme is designed to support is this swapping operation. So sometimes you want to swap, and sometimes, like for the login program, you want to just give up all your user IDs and run a program. So these calls, if called in the correct way, you have to just be very careful, let you either swap user IDs, or if you're root, like give up all your root permissions, like not be able to ever do root things again. Okay. So questions? So those are user IDs, and all the things I talked about for user IDs exist for group IDs. So there are things, there's a set group ID bit on executables. So rather than having a program that runs as a different user, you can have a program that runs as a different group in the same way, and there's also a real, effective, and saved group ID, which work the same way, and another set of these confusing setting functions for the group IDs. Okay, so those are group and user IDs. So this is sometimes known as an idea of ambient authority, that a process just happens to have some authority lying around, but it's never explicit. The permission information is always on the side. that you don't pass what user you are to open, you just have permissions and you call open. So there's an alternate approach that works very differently, which we're going to call capabilities, where instead of saying that you know you have some permissions and also you access the files, we're going to say that you're only going to be able to address or name things that you have permission to access. That's going to be how we're going to do our controls, rather than having this sort of separate access control list or permission stored on the side. We're going to say that you have a token to access a resource, and that token is your permission to access the resource. That you're not going to give a file name, you're going to get a token that lets you access the file. And that says whether you can do it. So this idea is known as capabilities. So you get this token that's typically opaque to you that identifies the resource, and because you have that token, you can access the resource. If you aren't allowed to access the resource, you don't get that token. And we've already seen the scheme in use. Some of the things that we've already seen are basically capabilities. So for example, file descriptors are lists of open files you have access to, and you access them with this opaque token, which is this file descriptor number, the index into that table. And once we have an open file, we don't check your permissions again. You have the ability to access the file because it's open. So this is a capability-based scheme, where we aren't checking every time you call read and write, can you access the file? We checked that once when we gave you this file descriptor, and now you have access to the file through the file descriptor. And you can think of page tables the same way for physical pages. That if you have an entry in the page table that identifies the physical page, you can access it, and your token is your virtual page number. And if you don't, you don't have an entry, you have no way of identifying that physical page. You can't give it an address. So these are capability lists. They're lists of what a process can access that we store with the process. And this simplifies permission checks. All our permission checks are done when we fill in this list. And after that, we don't check every time, can you read the file? We say, if it's in the list, you can access it. If it's not, you can't. And this is sort of the opposite of our access control list scheme, where we stored with files what you could access. Here we're storing with processes what they can access. So there are operating systems which are more heavily based on this idea of capabilities, where the idea is all our resources are going to be accessed with these tokens, that we're never actually going to do the thing where we have things like file names, and you can name any file, even ones you don't have access to. You're not going to be able to get the thing you need to access it at all, is the idea. Now, to make this make sense, we need some way of passing these tokens from programs to programs. And, well, we've seen that already with file descriptors. So let's talk about file descriptors as an example of this. That if I open a file, I can pass it to a program by just leaving it open. If I fork off that program, it still has that file descriptor. And this way, I can give a program access to a file. So if you think of like our set user ID scheme, we could have a set user ID program that opens a file for you and then runs you, not owned as that user, and you could still read that file. So we also have other ways of passing it. And a common feature that when you want to really take advantage of this idea of a list of things you can access stored with a process, you know, handles to access objects, as this new scheme for permissions, is that you'll have a way for programs to send these things like file descriptors, these tokens to access a resource, over inter-process communication like a local pipe or a socket. And this lets us do more sophisticated things that might start looking actually usable. So you might say, I can't access everything with tokens, I need my file names. Now with this scheme, I have a simple way of implementing file names. Every time we run a program, we give it the file descriptor for a socket, for a server, that will take in a file name and send back a capability if that program is allowed to access it. So now I've implemented my file permissions with that server, and I've done it where the OS just keeps track of these capabilities. So I've simplified my OS's permission checks. It just needs to implement this send a file descriptor from one process to another operation. So that's the sort of thing we can do when we can pass these tokens around, that if we're sending things from one program to another, we won't send a file name, we'll send this access token instead. And then we don't have to worry about making sure both of the programs that are communicating can both access the file. We don't have to set the permissions. We just know that because it's being passed from one program to another, we allow it. And if it's not being passed from one program to another, we don't. So questions about this sort of idea for controlling access to things like files? So people have tried to make whole OSs which are based on entirely using this model of permissions, never having access control lists, except maybe through like server programs that like handle the unfortunate realities of like needing to deal with passwords. There's also, to give a very concrete example, I'm going to go over a paper which did this sort of scheme on top of Unix. So they took Unix and they adapted it to work with this capability-based model. And this shows you like what the interface would look like if this is how we're doing our access control. If we aren't using access control lists, but instead we're doing this other idea. So they added this to FreeBSD, which is a POSIX-like operating system. And that meant they had to be backwards compatible. So this is an opt-in scheme where basically you can set a process to require capabilities for everything or not. So you can run the old programs in the or not mode and your new programs in this new mode where everything's capabilities, all the permission checks don't use access control lists. And their capabilities were just file descriptors. And they had file descriptors for some things we usually haven't had file descriptors for, like directories or processes. And the idea is now everything's a file descriptor. So the list of file descriptors is all the things you can access, all the processes you can kill, all the directories you can read files in, and so on. It's determined by what file descriptors your program has. We don't ever look at your program's UID and GID. There's no chmod anymore. And these file descriptors, well, we want to support things like read-only, write-only, so they had more permissions. So like the file descriptor might have an execute permission if you have a file descriptor for an executable and can execute it or not. They might, for a directory, we need a permission for can you open files in that directory or just list it. So we have some extra permission information that's stored with our file descriptor. And we've seen like already our file descriptor say, can we read with this and can we write with this? So this is just a few extra bits like that to support the new kinds of file descriptors we have. And for example, for processes, can you kill the process when you have a file descriptor for a process? And a thing about this capability design is because we don't have any access control list, there's no global names, because a global name implies we need to decide who can access that thing, if it's not, and it's not always going to be everyone. So rather, you have some starting point, like directories. So you get a file descriptor for a directory, like maybe your home directory, and you use that to access other files. So there's an open at system call, which takes a directory file descriptor and a file name, looks in that directory and gives you a file descriptor for that if the file descriptor permissions are set correctly. There's a system call for executing a file with its file descriptor. And there are no PIDs because PIDs are a global name and we don't want to have to look up a process ID and then figure out can you kill it. Instead, we want to have a file descriptor for a process and know it's in your file descriptor list, you can do some things with it. So we have a version of fork which returns a process descriptor, as they call it, which is one of your things in your list of open files. And we know if you have one, you can access the process. If you don't have that, well, you can't even name the process, so you can't access it. So the idea of this capability scheme is that the enforcement is really simple because all my system calls are going to take these file descriptors, and if there's no entry in my file descriptor table for the process or directory or file I want to access, I can't access it. And that means that as an operating system developer, I can't like skip or mess up this permission check very easily. Because the usual way I wouldn't have permission is there's no entry for that thing in the processes table. And that's why many operating system researchers really like this scheme for permissions over our access control list based one. Okay, so questions about this? Okay, so we'll finish up talking about a few miscellaneous security topics next time, and then talking about virtual machines.